Chapter 4, Westward Expansion and the Elaboration of an American Culture. The War of 1812 was, in a sense, a second war of independence, for before that time the United States had not yet been accorded equality in the family of nations. After the treaty ending that war, the United States was never again refused the treatment due an independent nation. Most of the serious difficulties that the young republic had faced since the Revolution now disappeared. National union brought a balance between liberty and order. With only a trifling national debt and a virgin continent awaiting the plow, a prospect of peace, prosperity, and social progress opened before the nation. To foster this self-sufficiency, Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun, congressional leaders of the time, urged protectionism, imposition of a tariff to foster the development of American industry. Stirrings of national consciousness appeared more and more strongly with the emergence of a truly American literature. Foremost among the writers of this new American school were Washington Irving and James Fenimore Cooper. Irving's humorous History of New York by Dietrich Knickerbocker, published in 1809, drew its inspiration wholly from the local American scene. Some of Irving's best work, such as the story of Rip Van Winkle, is set in the Hudson River Valley of New York and reveals America as a land of legend and romance. Founding in 1815 of the North American Review gave it an enduring place in the nation's developing culture. A force that did much to shape American literature, and more importantly, American life, was the frontier. Conditions along the entire Atlantic seaboard stimulated migration to the newer regions. From New England, whose soil was incapable of producing grain competitively with the cheap and fertile western lands, came a steady stream of men and women who left their coastal farms and villages to take advantage of the rich interior of the continent. In the back settlements of the Carolinas and Virginia, people handicapped by the lack of roads and canals giving access to coastal markets and suffering from the political dominance of the Tidewater planters also moved westward. This movement profoundly affected the American scene. It encouraged individual initiative. It fostered political and economic democracy. It roughened manners, it broke down conservatism, and it bred a spirit of local self-determination, coupled with respect for national authority. Farmers were soon followed by doctors, lawyers, storekeepers, editors, preachers, mechanics, politicians, all those who make up a vigorous society. The farmers were the sturdy base. Where they settled, they intended to stay and hoped their children would stay after them. They built large barns and sound brick or frame houses. They brought improved livestock, plowed the land skillfully, and sowed productive seed. Some erected flour mills, sawmills, distilleries. They laid out good highways, built churches and schools. Almost incredible transformations were accomplished in a few years. Thus, in 1830, Chicago was merely an unpromising trading village with a fort, but long before some of its original settlers died, it had become one of the largest and richest cities in the nation. In the West, men were valued not for family background, inherited money, or years of schooling, but for what they were and could do. Farms were easy to acquire. It was a time when, as the journalist Horace Greeley said, young men could go west and grow up with the country. Chief among these was the rise of a great cotton-growing industry in the South, stimulated by the introduction of new types of cotton and by Eli Whitney's invention, the cotton gin, for separating the seeds from cotton. In 1817, James Madison was succeeded in the presidency by James Monroe. The distinguishing event of the new administration was the enunciation of the so-called Monroe Doctrine. The basic elements of the doctrine, taken separately, were all well-organized American principles. Washington, Jefferson, and Madison had all advised against involvement in permanent or entangling alliances abroad. The people of the United States took a deep interest in what seemed a repetition of their own experience in breaking away from European rule. In 1822, President Monroe, under powerful popular pressure, received authority to recognize the new countries. On December 2, 1823, Monroe delivered to Congress his annual message, several passages of which constitute the Monroe Doctrine. First, The American continents, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintain, are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. Second, the political system of the Allied powers is essentially different from that of America. We should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety. Third, with the existing colonies or dependencies of any European power, we have not interfered and shall not interfere. Fourth, in the wars of the European powers in matters relating to themselves, we have never taken any part, nor does it comport with our policy to do so. During the administration of John Quincy Adams, new party alignments were formed. Adams' followers took the name of National Republicans, later to be changed to Whigs. In 1829, when Jackson became president, a current of unrest and revolt was coursing through the entire Western world. The reformed spirit in America, though it had its own sources of support, was thoroughly in harmony with this upsurge. The democratic upheaval in politics, exemplified by Jackson's election, was merely one phase of the common man's advance toward larger rights and opportunities. Labor's zeal for humanitarian reform was an essential element in all the progressive movements of the time, and particularly in the struggle for democracy in education. The spread of suffrage had already led to a new concept of education, for clear-sighted statesmen everywhere perceived the danger of universal suffrage among an untutored, even illiterate, electorate. The reforms that freed men from most of their ancient fetters awakened women to a realization of their unequal position in society. Meanwhile, in 1848, a women's rights convention, the first in the history of the world, was held at Seneca Falls, New York. Here, delegates drew up a declaration demanding equality with the male sex before the law in education and economic opportunities and in voting. In these years, the spirit of national self-confidence was finding expression in a great outpouring of literature. In day-by-day living, the welfare of the people was visibly improving. By 1850, only 20 years after the first horse-drawn public carrier, one could travel by rail from Maine to North Carolina, from the Atlantic seaboard to Buffalo on Lake Erie, and from the western end of Lake Erie to Chicago or Cincinnati. The electric telegraph, invented in 1835 by Samuel F.B. Morse, was first used in 1844. The rotary printing press, devised by Richard Howe in 1847, revolutionized publishing processes and played a major part in giving newspapers their commanding position in American life. Indicative of the growth of the nation from 1812 to 1852 was the rise in population from approximately 7,250,000 to more than 23 million. During this period, the land available for settlement increased to almost the size of the European continent, from 4,420,000 to 7,800,000 square kilometers. In addition to a flourishing agriculture, various industries were developing rapidly, not only on the eastern seaboard, but also in the fast-growing cities of the West. The durability of the nation and the vitality of its economy and institutions were established. Still unresolved, however, were the basic conflicts rooted in sectional differences, which, within the next decade, were destined to flare into civil war.
听力课堂，欢迎你。
听力课堂，欢迎你。
听啊，点儿啊。